Okay, please give a warm welcome to our speaker tonight, Brian from the Grace of Living Home Group.
Hey everybody, I'm Brian, I'm Mike Collins.
Hey Brian. Hey Brian.
My home group is actually Tuesday night, which one is the Brown Bag meeting, sorry. I switched so many times there in the last 4 or 5 years, I don't remember which one. But anyway, my sobriety date is September 26, 2001. I would like to say that I got a white chip and was a one-time chip wonder, but that isn't my story. I thought I had it one time. I was 6 months in, first chip. Thought I had this thing under control. Was headed to a meeting. Stopped at a store that I used to hang out at. A bunch of my friends were still there. Went home 4 days later. Didn't make it to the meeting. Didn't have any more sobriety after that moment. But anyway, I'm supposed to tell y'all what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I grew up in Chuckatuck, which is just a little bit down the road from here. It's a little bit farther now that the bridge is closed, but it's still not that far. Went to high school at John Yates. Went to Driver when they shut Chuckatuck Middle School down. And that's where I was from. My dad left when I was 10. Mom had 3 kids. I was the oldest. Dad used to come back and get me and take me hunting. At the age of 11 or 12, one of the club members' wife was pregnant and she was actually having a kid that day. Dad and them were drinking and celebrating the kid, thought it was okay for his kid to drink. So at 12 years old, I got drunk off AAA bourbon. And I don't know, man, it was right on time. I drank that and got sick, threw up in his girlfriend's bed, you know, just like a first time drinker, I guess. I drank too much. I was sick and didn't know it, woke up in different clothes and not really knowing where I was, and different sheets and all this stuff, and they told me what I did. And I came home and I had a shirt on, a pair of pants on or something, but it still had that bourbon where I spilt bourbon on it, and it smelled, and I was showing all my friends, look, I got to drink bourbon, you know. And I mean, I really thought I had arrived, you know what I mean? This was the thing that was gonna make me fit in with everybody. And it wasn't long after that, he would come home and do some work around the house, and Mom would leave and I'd be there, and he was drinking beer in the garage or in the carport, and he'd give me a can of beer and I'd get to go around the back of the house, and the older kids in the neighborhood were there and I'd share it with them, and then I'd go up and try to get another one. And that's how it kind of started. And it gave me a way in. And you know, I hit the ground running with it. I enjoyed it from right then. I was accepted. And when I got to hanging out with the older kids, of course the older kids were doing other things. I know this is, I call it anonymous meeting, I'll try to keep it as much as I can to the singleness of purpose. But it pretty much, if it was made, it would change the way I was thinking and feeling, I would do it. I would at least try it. And I did. So I did a whole lot of other things other than alcohol that I would try to leave out of this to the best I can and still tell y'all what it was like for me. When I got to about 16 years old, 15 years old, Dad had moved back. And I was hanging out with the older kids, like I said, and none of us were old enough to buy liquor. So my dad was, I thought at the time, the coolest dad in the world, because I could go to him and say, hey, Pop, we're going out tonight. We need you to go to the liquor store. He would say, all right, boy, come get me. We'd go pick him up, carry him to the liquor store. He'd get us whatever liquor we wanted, and then we'd carry him back. He'd always want at least a drink out of one of the bottles. And then his favorite saying was, all right, don't make me come piss on y'all's grave. And then let us go in the car with however many bottles of liquor we could afford to buy, and we would go and do what we did. And You know, that made me even a better person to hang around with, because now I was able to get things that everybody else wanted as well. And so in doing so, I found out that the more you do, the more it costs, and money becomes an issue. So I got into selling things that weren't legal, and needless to say, that landed me in a bunch of trouble. I was on probation already for trying to drive a car through a house. We were at a party, and they kicked us out of the house, and my cooler was inside, or our cooler was inside, and I decided I wanted it back, and they wouldn't let us in, so I rammed the car into the front door, and we got the cooler back. I got arrested the following morning when they finally found me, and it was Saturday night when this happened. On Sunday morning, Mom's getting up for church, and she said, "I don't know what the hell you did to my car last night, but it better be better when I get home from church." So I went out, started washing it, had a couple of tires that were almost flat, so I wouldn't put air in. When I came back, the cops were in the road. Before I got to the driveway, they were lights on, and they were getting me. And they left word with my sister and brother to tell my mom when she got home from church that I was being held at the Suffolk jail, waiting for her to come because I was a minor. So anyway, I ended up on probation for that. And the probation officers at that time realized that I guess I had a problem, so they would put me in all these drug and rehab classes and Tidewater Mental Health and all these kind of therapeutic kind of things. And I learned real quick to tell them what they wanted to hear, and they would like it, and I sounded like I was trying, and they would ease up on me. That all worked until I got caught selling illegal drugs, and then they realized I wasn't really doing any of the stuff I was saying I was doing, and I ended up on going to court over that. And I was 17 years old. I had multiple felony charges for distribution, and when I went to court, they took me into juvenile court, and the judge said, "Well, he's not a juvenile now. We're sending him to adult court." So I went to adult court. My lawyer told me I was going home that day. I did not go home that day. I went to jail, stayed in jail, and they gave me 15 years. I stayed in jail for a year, got out on parole, and upon release, I was put on probation. They gave me 25 years probation. I was, they liked me there. I got that, and I got out, and I had to go to the probation thing, go to more Tidewater Mental Health. And I went to so many Tidewater Mental Health 12-week programs that I had, after 12 weeks, they give you these certificates that you completed the 12-week classes. And I had them stapled up on my wall while I was still doing all the stuff that I was doing. Hey, I passed the class, I put it on. I thought it was a big joke. I managed to leave everything alone that would get me in trouble, so I thought, other than drink. And so I kept drinking, and it ended up, a friend of mine at the time told me, if you do this drug, it only stays in your system 3 days, and you'll be able to do, you can still pass your urine test at probation office and do this. So I tried it. The problem is you have to stop for 3 days. And that became an issue. I really liked that drug, and with alcohol, it was even that much better. And so I continued, and then I couldn't do it. I couldn't not get in trouble or not pass the drug test. And my probation officer, I had gone through several of them at that time. And the last one I had, Mr. Ellis, he tried everything to help me. He really did. He tried. He gave me every break. And finally, they had this thing. They came around and told us to show up at the probation. Our DOC had a class that they were introducing three new programs to people on probation. Well, when you went in, what it was they gave you a drug test. If you failed it, you went to jail. If you passed it, you got to go home. Well, I didn't go home. I ended up in the jail. I ended up staying in there 30 or 90 days and went to court. And I had been 14 years since I had gotten arrested, and went to prison to the time that I got for this dirty urine test. So when I went up, I had a lawyer. The lawyer said, look, he was out 14 years. But the judge started reading off all the charges I had. He said, yeah, but he's had assault and battery. He's had DUI. He's had hit and runs. He's had dirty urines this long. Why the hell have y'all violated him before now? And my probation officer that was trying to help me so much really got his ass chewed out for trying to help, for being lenient, I guess. And but they let me go. They let me go, told me zero alcohol, zero drugs, no exception, come back, get 3 years. So I went home, I'm in the carport, I'm drinking beer, probation officer rolls up. He says, you know I gotta violate you drinking beer. So I said, I'll pour it out. I don't have to drink it. I poured it out. He said, I'm still got a violation. You got to come to my office tomorrow. Well, it had only been 14 days since I got out. So I didn't think it was a good idea to go turn myself in. So I didn't go. And I stayed out for another month or two. And by then they put capes on me. And they're looking for me. If I got in trouble, they would have got me, I'm sure. But anyway, I decided, okay, I better go turn myself in. I've been out for a while. So I went in, went up, said, hey, Mr. Ellis, I'm here to turn myself in. He said, okay, sit out in the lobby, and I'll go get the detectives, and we'll carry you to jail. Well, they took too long. I got up and left. I said, it's still not a good day. I'm going to leave. I walked home from downtown Suffolk back to Chuckatuck through the back roads because I didn't want them to see me walking down the main roads. And I made it home and stayed out for about another 30 days before I went back and turned myself in again. And this time, he did tell me that I could sit in the lobby again. The guy was a great guy, but he wasn't real smart when it comes to that. I was sitting in the lobby and I was dipping at the time. I started chewing it back. So I walked outside to dip, and he thought I'd run again. He'd come flying down, and you should have seen him when he saw me. It was a big sigh of relief, but he was panicking that I had left again, and he had let me go again. But I didn't go that time, so they took me back to court, and the judge gave me the 3 years like he said he was going to do. And I said, well, that ain't nothing. I got old law. I'll be out in less than 6 months. That's pretty easy, you know what I mean? And I did the math wrong. I stayed in for 18 months. And before they let me out, they come to give me, on the old law, you still got to go in front of the parole board and see if you could get parole. So when I went up, it was less than 30 days, the time they had to mandatory let me go because I had done all my time. So when I went in there, they told me, I said, I don't care what y'all do. Y'all got 30 days, you got to let me go anyway. And what I said, because I went home like 2 days later. I wasn't very nice in there. I didn't care at that point because I was going home anyway. And I got home, and back up a minute. While I was in Suffolk City Jail at the time, though, I got home. I got a sponsor, Dennis White, and he was my sponsor. And we started working the steps. And I got home and I was headed home. I told Dennis, I'm on the way home. I'll be home Wednesday night. What should I do? And he told me where the meeting was. So I met Dennis there, and I was coming back from Northern Virginia when my mom came and picked me up from Northern Virginia. I was coming home and I thought of like 300 reasons why not to go to that meeting. I'm like, I just got home. I got an 11-year-old daughter at home. I need to go home and see her. I hadn't seen her in 18 months, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, I went to that meeting. Ended up going to that meeting. Told him I was home. He met me there. I thought, this is cool. A lot of the people that brought the meetings to the jail were at that meeting. I said, cool, they heard I was getting released. They came to the meeting, said I was going to be there. And this is pretty neat. They must really like me, And they told me where the meeting was the following night, and one of the guys there actually started coming to pick me up, carrying me to the meetings, and he did that for a couple of weeks. But everywhere I went, they were there. And I was like, well, damn, they're following me. This is pretty awesome. But it gave me, I guess, a sense of belonging enough that it was kind of like the drugs did. and alcohol did back in when I started. I felt like I fit in from the beginning in that room from that Wednesday night on. And like I said, it was 30 days or so before I realized I quit thinking of me so much and it was all about me that I realized that they're going to those meetings because they're trying to do what I'm doing and trying to stay sober on a regular basis. And this is what they do. And me and Dennis started working those steps on Sunday nights at Highland. That was my original home group. And that was my home group for probably 14 years. I would meet Dennis. The meeting was at 7. At first, it was at 8. I'd meet Dennis at 7. We'd work on a step and go through the book and then go to the meeting. And after I'd been out for a year, I was able to go back into jails. And I went back into jails and carried a meeting in the jail with Dennis for a while. And then they got on us about wearing paraphernalia and all this stuff into the jails, having motorcycle club vests on and that kind of stuff. And it kind of pissed me and Dennis both off, and neither one of us kept going to jail. we did that for a while, and it was a great thing. It was scary. Going back in there for the first night, I went back in there and that door buzzed and I got to go inside and then the door slammed shut and I was like, how the hell they let me out of here, you know? But they did, you know, they did. And that was another great thing I was able to do. And my sponsor, Dennis, he rode motorcycles. When I first got home, there was a group here called Third District Motorcycle Club. They used to come into the meetings that I went to, and they would all come in with the jackets on. And I was like, you know, I might be able to do this here because I could ride bikes again. I rode bikes before when I was drinking and stuff. And anyway, I was like, I might be able to do it. And then I walked outside, and they were all on fucking Hondas. You know, I'm like, what the hell? I don't know that I can do this. You know, it wasn't the Harley Davidson in the bunch, man. And anyway, I found out that most of them were just cheap. They didn't want to buy the Harley. And when they could buy the Harley, they did. And then the Harleys were the best bikes in the world. But when they were riding the Hondas, they were the best bikes. But anyway, I joined that motorcycle club. And I rode with them guys for about 11 years. And we carried meetings around, and we showed up at meetings in our group. And that was all good. We took meetings to club, the halfway houses and stuff up around Charlottesville. That's where a lot of these guys were up in that area, up in northern Richmond. And we'd ride up there, bike rallies, and it was just a good time. And so I did that and had a blast. And here I am. I get to ride motorcycles again. You know, I got somebody I can hang out with. You know, and it's cool. And it was real cool till Sons of Anarchy came on. You know, and then everybody wanted to be the outlaw motorcycle club again. I'm like, y'all know we're a clean and sober club. We don't even fit in. Y'all all of a sudden wearing knives and all this crap. You know, you're gonna get us killed is what you're gonna do. And, anyway, after all that happened, we had a big thing and had a vote, and they got to keep wearing the knives and stuff. And I said, "Well, I'm retiring. I'm getting out of the club. We're portraying something we're not. We're not an outlaw motorcycle club." And they pretty much have folded up now. But anyway, it was an old guy there named John that some of y'all might know, Elder. He was quite a bit older than me, and me and that old man rode a lot of miles up on motorcycles together. And one of those club rallies, I had gone to the dentist, and my now wife was my hygienist. First time I met her, I'd just come back from a rally. I had my vest on, riding my motorcycle, and I walked in. We got to talk, and I showed her pictures from the bike rally, and I guess it was love at first sight for her and me. I was leaving. This is the story she tells. Her and a girl, one of the hygienist ladies there, were looking out the window. The other lady said, "What are y'all doing?" She said, "I'm looking at my future husband." And that was from the first thing. And then 3 months later, we were engaged, buying a house, and we've been together 18 years. So, you know, it's been a blessing. She's never seen me drunk. I'm glad. if I would have been in active addiction and stuff, if she hadn't ran away when she met me, I would have robbed that woman blind. Because that's just the type of alcoholic and addict I am. I was not a very trustworthy. I was a very good person with very bad habits. I would, you know, when it came to the supporting my addictions, I would rob from you, I would lie to you, I'd steal from you. It was just, all bets were off, you know, at that point. I'm not proud of that. That's just what addiction did to me. It robbed me of all of that moral and honesty and the stuff y'all taught me how to do since I've been here, how to be a decent person, how to be a friend among friends, you know. And anyways, luckily she hasn't had to see that. And I hope with the help of y'all and my God and my understanding, she never does. You know, my grandkids, I got two grandkids, one's 9 and one's 2. Neither one of them have ever seen me take a drink. And they don't know Papa's that person, you know. When I used to get up here and tell my story, my wife would come and listen to it. And then she'd go home and tell my mom some of the stuff I said up here. And mom, she would be like, did you know he did this? And she said, I know everything he did. You know what I mean? She lived through all that hell back then. And it was very vivid to her. And she didn't find it as entertaining as my wife did. And she finally had to tell her, you know, that's not a very happy part of my life, when watching my son go through that stuff. And you know, I was in and out of jail a couple of different little times for little short things, and then a couple of longer things. But I always just took it for granted that I was allowed to go home, you know. And after working with my sponsor this time, I had enough gratitude, I guess, to say, hey, Mom, is it okay if I come home? You know, am I allowed to come home this time? You know, I haven't been that son that I should be around you. I haven't been the dad to my daughters I should be. And my mom was actually raising my daughter at that time. So, you know, am I allowed? And she did let me come in. And, you know, that started us. When did that meeting? After a little while, I met my wife. We were getting married, and we got married in the backyard of the house we live in now. And I actually invited probation officers. I had like 6 or 8 probation officers come to my wedding. That was pretty freaking awesome. When I first got out, the last time I got out, I was sitting I had a tense probation, they called it. I had to go once a week and see the probation officer. I'm sitting in there, it's a new woman, I hadn't met her, and we're sitting in our office for the first time going through the introduction, and the door's open, and probation officer walked by and said, hey, Brian, how you doing? And, you know, hey, Miss So-and-so, how you doing? Hey, Miss So-and-so, how you doing? And it went on 6-7 people, you know, and she said, you know, a lot of these probation officers. And I said, they've actually been my probation officers. You know, I've been in here a long time. At that time, it was 2001. I got on probation in 1987, 86. So it's been a little while. I've been in around there. And anyway, they came to my wedding. And, you know, to me, it was a big deal. Today, it's still a big deal. To have these people that saw me in active addiction and my disease of alcoholism come to my wedding and give me money as gifts, to show that they've seen that much of a change in me and the steps of the Alcoholics Anonymous, the life I was living today in Alcoholics Anonymous, they had seen that much of a change, you know, to do that. That, to me, says a lot. It says a heck of a lot. And, you know, there's one lady in there, Miss Miltier, she was the substance abuse probation officer that had a meeting every week on Tuesday nights. We had a meeting, relapse prevention meeting at the probation office. And that woman, she taught me a lot about a lot. And she used to say that She considered me kind of like a butterfly or a caterpillar. She watched me go from this to turn into this. You know what I mean? Through the whole process, and she was one of the ones at my wedding, and she actually had stopped by a couple times and just say hey, you know, and it's pretty awesome to have that relation today with probation. You know, it's not all about that, and you know, thank God that I was on all that, because that opened doors that may not have gotten open. I can be grateful today that they put me on probation that long, because like I said, I was good, or I stayed out of trouble for that 14 years. If I hadn't been on that, I wouldn't have had a dirty urine test. They didn't put me back in jail. I might have gone to this a lot further in life before I got the help that I needed, or got the attention that I needed to have help with this disease. So I'm grateful for that today. And I wasn't in the beginning. It's funny how my perception has changed, you know, about what I consider good and bad. Going to jail the last time was the best thing that happened to me. It got me back with my sponsor. I'd asked that guy to be my sponsor the 90 days before when I was in, and then I got home and was out for 14 days. I'd asked Dennis to be my sponsor then, and never made it, you know. It didn't work out that time, and then it did the second time. But anyway, it saved my life. It really saved my life, and it let me come home and be the son that I should have been, to be the dad that I could be, and all that stuff. I owe all that Alcoholics Anonymous, the 12 steps of this program. It has opened doors up that I did not think would have been available to me. And I don't know why I did this time. Like I said, I was offered this way back at 16 years old, 15 years old. They put me in all these drug classes and alcohol classes, and for whatever reason, I didn't hear it. I didn't want to hear it. I didn't act on it. The help was there. It didn't get in. And why it came in this time is still a mystery to me, because I was just as hard-headed as I was any of the times before. But it got in. Something got through the door enough, and once that got through, and then I got with working the steps. That's the only thing that I did different this time, was I got a sponsor and we actually started working the 12 steps. That's what I believe a lot of it is. I think the solution, I think we all have said that, the solution is in the 12 steps. It tells us that. I'm still hard-headed about that sometimes, and I don't bring that up enough, I guess. But if you're not doing it, in my opinion today, if you're not doing the 12 steps, you're not doing the recovery part of the program. You can be in the program, but I don't think you're in the recovery part of the program. That's where I got it anyway. Everybody does it their own way. So, I mean, I can't tell you that's how you have to do it, but that, for me, that's what I had to do. And in doing so, I haven't had to take a drink. I haven't had to do any drugs since then. I hadn't had to go back to jail. I made a joke a little while ago, you know, I don't know if it's a joke or it ain't. It might come true one day, but the healthcare system ain't that great in this world, and the damn money ain't that good. Jail's free. I can go back to jail and get free medical and place to stay, watch TV all day and play bidwist. I mean, at 80, that don't sound too freaking bad to me. It really doesn't, especially if I don't have anything else. I've lived on the streets enough. I've slept on fire trails. I've took showers in campgrounds. I've done everything that active addiction people do to get by. That sounds worse to me than jail. That I would rather go back to jail than go back to that life. I know that much. Today I would. I don't know how life would be if I would have kept going. I don't know that I would still be alive. I probably wouldn't be. I was doing a lot of things that would probably have killed me by now. I don't know why I was allowed to survive it up to now, other than maybe just to be here to share a story with one person that hears it that may need to hear it. I don't know what God's big picture is for me. I do know that I've been taught that I'm supposed to go through my day and carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous and to spread the word that I believe in a higher power. And I believe that that's what saved my life. And if you're an addict and an alcoholic to the extent that I was, that there is hope that you can get sober and clean and have a life that's beyond your wildest dreams if you do what we do. And that might be the only reason that I'm still standing here, to say that on a Friday night at 8 o'clock. I don't know. You know, and it's all it has to be. It's all it has to be. I used to, when I first started talking in meetings, and we'd be in a discussion meeting, I would sit there, and my prayer in that meeting would be, I don't care if it makes sense what I say, if it's heard by the person that needs to hear it, just let it come out of my mouth, whatever that is. It doesn't have to make sense to me at all. Because I hear stuff differently than is said sometimes, you know what I mean? And so for me to understand what I'm saying sometimes might not make any sense to me, but might make perfect sense to you. And that's the hope, that whoever needs it gets it. I know y'all brought it to me, and I share this a lot. I could go out of these rooms and never come back and go and die and not call it death. Nobody would ever, the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous would not change. But I can change if I come in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not any big golden medallion of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm just an alcoholic and a drunk. And a drug addict that shows up and says, hey, this saved my life. This saved my life. Y'all saved my life. Y'all brought me the message of Alcoholics Anonymous and the hope that comes along with it. And I have a life that I couldn't do on my own. I could not do this on my own. I've had plenty of people try to help me. And it just did not catch until this time. And I don't know why. I don't know why I did this time. Maybe, I don't know why. I'm glad it did. I'm just grateful that it did. Some of y'all know, and this, I share this a lot too, because it was a life scary moment for me. About a year and a half ago, I'm coming home from going to Kentucky. Me and a buddy decided we're going to leave on a Friday morning, drive to Kentucky to get a freaking t-shirt at a Harley shop and then come back home. We did that. We rode there, got to Kentucky, got the t-shirt, coming back home, stopped at the New River Gorge Bridge, stayed in Roanoke, I think it was, that night, and got on a motorcycle next morning. Hour into the ride, I hit a deer at 65 mile an hour, man, and it wiped me out. And never saw it coming. I got up and walked away from the damn wreck. You know, I don't know how that's even possible. The deer didn't make it. The bike didn't make it. Well, the bike's rebuilt now, but it didn't make it. I didn't ride away from there. And anyway, I got to walk away. So evidently, I got a message for somebody, somewhere, someplace, something, because I'm not that tough. I'm not that tough, but it was a guy that had put his hand out and did something that day to keep me here and not be broke up and still be. I know it. And I've said it all night. I used to would not tell y'all if I was praying to any God. I would not show y'all that I was praying to any God. I would not admit that God is doing anything, because that was a sign. I took it as a sign of weakness. If I can't do it on my own, I'm not going to admit that I need this God that I can't even touch or see or anything. And that's what's doing it. But I've become a believer of that, that there's a God, a higher power out there that has unconditional love for this hard-headed alcoholic and wants nothing but good for me. And it's helped me when I did not give him any bit of praise or any bit of thank you or any bit of anything. I just took it all for granted. Just like I took for granted that I could go home. and right after that, you know, I was just that person. And I know today that that ain't true. I do believe that there's a power out there greater than me that wants me to be happy, joyous, and free. It wants me to go around and tell people that there is one, and that the rooms, I call it synonymous, can save you from years of misery if you would let it, if you would just do the 12 steps, Alcoholics Anonymous. I got up here, I was thinking on the way here, what am I gonna say? And it says, tell your spirit, strength, and hope. You know, that's what it says that we're supposed to do. And I get up here and I'm like, all right, I'm gonna do this much of this, this much. I ain't done one damn thing that I thought of. It has all come out differently. So to me, that's the best thing. I feel like I'm all over the place up here talking about, I don't know how far I am off subject or not or whatever, but I feel like I can come in here, I don't have to study to get up here and talk about Alcoholics Anonymous. I just get up here and talk. You know, I got lucky, there's a operator that I'm working with right now that he hadn't been in the rooms for a while. He says he's sober. I hope he is. He's got a different disease. He's in the NA part instead of the AA part, but hey, it is what it is. And anyway, the last few days we've been talking, and today he's like, you know, I ain't been to meetings in a while. My wife started going, they just separated. He said, but my wife started going back, and she's not having none of this anxiety and crap that I have. And he said, maybe I should go back to the meetings. And I said, do you think? Yeah, maybe you should, you know, but I don't know. Maybe just in our conversation, he knows I'm in there because I've shared that. So maybe it's helped. Maybe he'll go back, you know, maybe so. Who knows? Hopefully he'll stay sober regardless, but I don't know. I'm glad that I'm here. I'm glad y'all are here. I know the police department's glad that I'm here. probation, parole, glad that I'm in here. I have a daughter that loves me where, by all rights, she should have given up on me when I was in active addiction. I've shared this, and this is one of my better things. The clock that won't come back on. But anyway, I want to share it just because I was on the way home from work. It was her fifth or sixth birthday. She's at my mom's house. I'm on my way home to go to her birthday. I stopped at the bar for one drink. Don't make it home. Missed the old birthday. I got a backseat car full of presents that I had gotten, but never got there to give them to her. When I showed up the next day, I don't understand why my mom's mad at first. She's mad as hell at me, and I'm not figuring out why. And I'm not even thinking about the presents. I'm still oblivious to this. I haven't woke up enough to realize that I'd missed it. You know, that's not even in my brain. So I say, why are you mad? She said, you missed your daughter's birthday yesterday. I said, oh crap, yeah I did, but I got presents in the car. She said, it ain't nothing to do about the presents. She said, your daughter stood at the door several times looking out to see if you were pulling in the driveway. That crushed me, you know, it crushed me. And I haven't had to do that since I got in the room that I call it Anonymous. I haven't missed another birthday. And that kid still loves me, you know. So I'm going to close with that. But I'm glad y'all are here to help me through my addictions and help me to stay sober one day at a time. And if nobody else says it, there used to be a guy that said this all the time in the meetings. Says, nobody else says this to you today, I love you. Yep. Mm-hmm. And you remember that too, huh, Roger? And so anyway, thank y'all.
Thank you.